President Obama supports same-sex marriage.
What that might mean for his campaign fundraising.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith in New York. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org for Thursday, May 10th.
Coming up, cash, credit, or phone.
And China gets territorial.
It's all coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
President Obama made waves yesterday when he announced his support of gay marriage. The news came on the heels of a Gallup poll this week that found half of Americans now support allowing same-sex couples to wed. That brings us to our weekly attitude check, a partnership with Gallup.
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Frank Newport is Gallup's editor-in-chief. He joins us now. Good morning, Frank.
Hi, good morning.
So tell me, what were the results of this poll?
Well, we asked basically about legalized same-sex marriage, and we found the country is split right down the middle. 50% support it, 48% are opposed to it. Last year, it was slightly higher, but when you average the last 3 years' worth of polling together, we find it's about half and half. The demographics of support for same-sex marriage are very youth-skewed, so as young people get older, they will probably carry those attitudes with them, and the country's headed, it looks like, to have an increasing percent who support legalized gay same-sex marriage.
Now, you mentioned that it's a highly political issue. Do we have any idea of how this might play out among voters?
Ah, that's the fascinating question. No doubt Barack Obama and his campaign team spent endless hours figuring that out before
right.
he made his decision. No, we don't. I mean, we know the economy is overwhelmingly the dominant issue. We just ask Americans what's the most important problem facing the country, and 66% says something relating to the economy. Nobody mentioned same-sex marriage, volunteered it as the top problem facing the country. So it's not a major issue. It's dwarfed by the economy overall. But at the edges, in terms of motivating groups on either side of the spectrum, highly religious white voters who would be Romney supporters versus liberal voters on the other end of the spectrum who would support Obama, it could have an impact on motivating these voters.
And finally, Frank, how did this break down by region?
Well, the South, of course, is the most Republican and by far the most religious section of the country. Mississippi is a single state, which is the most religious state in the country. By the way, Vermont is the least religious state in the country. So clearly, people in the Bible Belt in the South are most likely to be opposed to same-sex marriage. But most of those states, Florida being an exception, are going to vote for the Republican candidate anyhow. Elsewhere, you know, the Northeast, these states are not religious, but they're mostly going to vote for Obama. So regionally, I think the impact of this decision will follow religiousness and politics, kind of the division that we already have there regionally in American states.
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief of Gallup. Frank, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, President Obama will be here in Southern California tonight for a fundraiser. He's hoping to pull in $15 million. And his announcement about same-sex marriage will probably make him especially popular in Hollywood. That's good news for the president because this year, a lot of the Wall Street money he got in his last campaign is going to Mitt Romney. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports.
4 years ago, Hollywood was gaga for Barack Obama. Entertainers had donated over $4 million to his campaign by this point. This time around, it's about half that. But between tonight's gala and some mega-sized super PAC donations from studio head Jeffrey Katzenberg and comedian Bill Maher, Obama clearly can still count on Hollywood. Lucky for him, especially since he's losing some of his Wall Street donations to Romney. Bob Bierzak at the Center for Responsive Politics says Mitt and Wall Street, it's a no-brainer.
He comes from that business. That's home for him. Those people have known him for years, and he was successful in that industry, and so he has lots of friends, I'm sure.
Not to mention Obama's comments about fat cat bankers. After tonight's $40,000-a-ticket affair, the president's due back in Hollywood next month. He'll be raising campaign funds from gay donors, and that should be sold out as well, especially in light of the president's same-sex marriage endorsement yesterday. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
The government gave us some numbers on U.S. trade this morning. Both imports and exports hit record levels last month, though economists say exports could fall in coming months if things get worse in Europe, which buys a lot of stuff from us.
And Europe is where we'll go now with Gus Fauché, senior economist with PNC Financial. He's with us now from Pittsburgh. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Gus, let's start with Spain, where the government there just took over one of the country's largest banks. Do you think there's the potential for a full-scale banking crisis in Europe?
There is the potential for a full-scale crisis, but I think the steps that Spain is taking are reducing the odds of that, and that's good news both for the Eurozone economy and for the U.S.
Okay, so perhaps not a banking crisis at the moment. That's good. What about Greece, Gus? There were elections over the weekend. They still have not formed a government. A new government might have to go back and have a new round of elections. And there's a lot of talk about Greece maybe leaving the euro. What do you think?
Well, I think the Greek voters are fed up with austerity, but it's not clear whether or not they want to leave the eurozone. So I'm hopeful that the situation in Greece will settle out so that the nation decides to stay in the eurozone, because if it leaves, that could open the door for great chaos there.
You think that it's going to be up to the Greeks whether they stay?
I think so, yes. They need to make a political decision and they need to make an economic decision as to whether the eurozone is the correct choice for them, and I think it is.
So on a scale of 1 to 10, how concerned are you about Europe having a big impact on our economy right now?
I'm at about a 5 right now. I think things have settled down somewhat. There's some confusion over Greece. But I think in the past I've been in an 8 or a 9, so I think things are looking a little bit more stable there now.
5 sounds pretty good compared to that. Gus Fauché, senior economist with PNC Financial, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Well, the Federal Reserve has approved the plans of 3 state-backed Chinese banks to expand into the United States. Chinese banks have been trying to get a foothold here for years, but have mostly been blocked.
Meanwhile, China's government is ratcheting up the rhetoric about its claims to a disputed part of the South China Sea. Both China and the Philippines claim the area, which has massive oil and natural gas reserves. Our China bureau chief, Rob Schmitz, has more.
China's state-run media make it sound like war with the Philippines is inevitable. One headline this week read, "Peace will be a miracle if tensions continue." Why the tough posturing?
I have to think that it's connected with the leadership changeover.
William McCahill is an investment bank executive and formerly a senior U.S. diplomat in China. China changes leaders at the end of the year, and an embarrassing scandal involving one of them is threatening to postpone the transition. McCahill says Beijing may be using a potential conflict with the Philippines as a diversion. He wouldn't be surprised if the Chinese Navy soon conducts military exercises near the disputed territory. But McCahill worries about the commanders in charge.
They lack combat experience and, in a way, are not quite so sensitive to the consequences of their actions.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says the U.S. won't take sides, but the U.S. did just triple its military aid to the Philippines this year. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Now to Russia, which is dealing with a human tragedy this morning after one of its passenger planes crashed into a volcano in Indonesia yesterday. There were 45 people on board and no signs of survivors. The other part of the tragedy for Russia is that the plane was its first new model passenger jet since the fall of the Soviet Union. Reporter Peter Van Dyke joins us now from Moscow with more. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, Peter, tell us about the implications of this plane crash for Russia's aviation industry.
Well, the Sukhoi Superjet 100 is really what the Russian aviation industry has invested all its hopes in after a very, very bad 20 years since the end of the Soviet Union. Now, it was on a promotional flight. They are hoping to sell a lot of these planes to Asia. It's a mid-range regional jet, seats around about 80 passengers. And it hopes to be very competitive in these markets where Russia is again trying to establish itself as a potential provider of planes.
And Russia does not have a great history when it comes to civil aviation, especially in recent years, right?
No, that's very true. The number of crashes in Russia and the former Soviet Union is quite a long list, and many of them, like this one, involving a lot of casualties. And these crashes are caused by a number of factors, the aging Soviet-era fleet, but also there is problems with pilot training, with ground crew, with maintenance, and with infrastructure at airports. So all these things combined make for some pretty big problems for the Russian aviation industry, and that's something that the Sukhoi Superjet is trying to overcome. But increasingly, Western firms such as Boeing are doing more and more business in this market.
Reporter Peter Van Dyke joining us from Moscow. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
There's an article in the latest Profile magazine about changes in the workplace, the design and layout of the workplace, that is.
For today's Midday Extra, we're joined by Kelly Bacon, Director of Business Development and Workplace Strategy at TPG Architecture in New York. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. So, Kelly, what kind of changes are you seeing when it comes to the design and the layout of people's workspaces?
We're seeing quite a few changes, actually. The evolution of the workplace is trending more towards employee empowerment. And by that, I mean it's providing choices for individuals and the staff to choose how they want to work throughout the day. And by that, I mean that work is happening more and more away from the desk. So the individual workspaces that were once, you know, 8x8 cubicles with higher walls are moving more towards what we call benching systems, which is table desking, which results in higher density, which is more people in smaller areas. But with that space is not going away. It's being reallocated to what we call zones or the amenity spaces, which is essentially your quiet areas, your cafes, your team rooms, your collaboration areas, or what have you. And essentially what that does is it's allowing people to choose where and how they want to get their work done based on what it is that they actually have to achieve.
So, Kelly, you've touched on this, but what are these changes supposed to achieve?
Research shows that people essentially move in and out of four work modes throughout the day. You have your focus, your individualized work. You have your collaboration, which is your meetings, your conversations, et cetera. And you have your formalized training, and then you have what's called socializing, which is essentially how information gets spread throughout the organization. Now, you can't focus if you have a meeting happening 2 feet away from you.
Right.
So those two concepts really are mutually exclusive. So based on what I have to do throughout the day, I can choose. If I need to focus, I can go into either a quiet area or a library or one of these spaces that's allocated towards private and focused work. If I need to meet with my team, if I need to get some impromptu feedback, then I can go to a team area or walk over to one of the collaborative rooms and meet with my group. So it allows more of a seamless transition. Anybody who's worked in a less efficient office space knows, you know, the frustration that one can feel when they need to have an impromptu meeting, but all the conference rooms are booked.
But Kelly, let me play devil's advocate here, because I've worked in an office several years ago in a newsroom, and it did what a lot of newsrooms these days are doing, which is to go from a situation where you have offices for individual people to putting them in this big bullpen where everybody is, you know, everybody's together. You have no privacy. You can't make phone calls by yourself without going into one of these rooms, as you say. I mean, it seems like I felt the way, and everybody I know who's been put in that situation feels that it makes the workplace much less pleasant.
You know, that's an excellent point. And there's a lot of research now that's looking at personality types and
Are you saying it's me? Are you saying it's me, Kelly?
No. Maybe your personality is not conducive to that arrangement.
Jeremy's very collaborative.
No, but Beth, it is an excellent point. And there is some of the research does show that, for instance, introverts don't fare as well in an open floor plan environment as extroverts do. And it's not necessarily fair to put people in that situation and not allow them to do the work or work the way that they work the best. And so that is very important to pay attention to that. And we talk about designing for choice and providing those choices.
Is there any personalized space in these areas at all? Or is this sort of the end of the era of being able to put up your photos and Kathy comics and stuff like that?
It really differs based on the organization. You know, some of our clients are not even remotely interested in moving away from individualized or owned space. Hmm. And I don't think that's ever going to go away completely, but the space that's allocated just for you is just getting a bit smaller. So you do have your home base. It's just, it's no longer 8x8 workstations. You're getting a smaller area, but you still, I would have the option to reserve a meeting room or, you know, a larger area, or when I need a change of pace, I can go into a cafe.
Kelly Bacon is Director of Business Development and Workplace Strategy at TPG Architecture in New York. Thanks a lot, Kelly.
Thank you so much.
So, Stacey, developers in New York City say they could save $20 million if they drop plans to put an ornamental white shell around the antenna on the top of the new World Trade Center building. That's according to the Wall Street Journal. But if they remove the shell, it could mean that the building will not technically become the tallest structure in the U.S. when it's completed next year.
Oh, wow.
That's because when it comes to skyscraper heights, apparently spires count, but antennas do not. So if they have the spire, they put the shell around it, it would reach 1,776 feet officially. But if it's just the antenna, then they can only count it, I guess, from the top of the building itself. And without that, it is 1,368 feet, which
is... That is a 400-foot antenna?
I guess so. And
that's,
and it's
amazing.
Also, it's just 1,368. I don't know what happened in the year 1,368, but it doesn't have quite the ring to it of 1,776.
No, that's true. And from physical ups and downs to economic ups and downs now, a new report from the Pew Charitable Trust says your ability to achieve the American dream depends on where you live. The report maps economic mobility across all 50 states. From the Marketplace Wealth and Poverty Desk, Shireen Meraji reports. Well, we're moving
on now. Remember the Jeffersons? George and Wheezy moved from working class Queens to the Upper East Side. Well, New York is one of the states that did well in Pew's economic mobility study, right along with New Jersey and Maryland. In those states, more people moved up the income ladder and fewer down it compared to the rest of the U.S., a region that didn't fare as well.
The South performs consistently worse than the national average.
Aaron Currier's team at Pew just crunched the numbers, but Isabel Sawhill studies social mobility at Brookings and says education most likely plays a role. In 2000, she says, one in three people living in Maryland had a bachelor's degree. Compare that to one in five in South Carolina.
Not only do better educated people earn more, they experience faster earnings growth during their prime working years.
Pew's study doesn't include the recession years. So right now, education may not help you move on up, but it will help you stay employed. I'm Shireen Meraji for Marketplace.
A big cell phone industry conference in New Orleans wraps up today. This year's big theme, turning your phone into a mobile wallet. But one question remains unresolved. Who will benefit the most from the new technology? Marketplace's Eve Tro takes a look.
When we shop in actual stores, we pay with plastic or cash. But soon, techies agree, millions of us will pay with cell phones. Lots of companies, from banks to websites, really want to help us do that. At the convention, Visa, MasterCard, and PayPal rolled out new systems to pay by phone.
All jockeying for position, all trying to get their brand accepted.
Anil Malhotra is there with his wireless company, Bango. He says winning the mobile payment space is about convincing individual shoppers, but also
getting that merchant network to accept your payment method.
Visa and MasterCard have an edge because most shoppers and merchants already trust them with money, says David Wolman, author of the book The End of Money. But cell phone companies?
You know, it's one thing if you drop my calls. It's another thing if you drop my money and it vanishes into cyberspace.
So we'll likely see more wireless companies partner with big names in finance, like Visa and MasterCard. Now they just need to get more stores to ask at the checkout, cash, credit, or phone. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace. Building a highway these days is a little trickier than it was back in the 1950s. There's a lot more stuff in the way now. Just ask lawmakers in Illinois who were preparing to vote on a bill to fast-track construction of a highway east of Chicago.
That's right. It's called the Illiana Expressway, which would, as its name suggests, connect Illinois to Indiana. But the method the state wants to use to get the land for that freeway isn't sitting well with many residents in the path. From WBEZ in Chicago, Lauren Chulgin reports.
When Todd Benjamin and his wife Colleen found out about the project, they raced to their computer to see if the state was planning to seize part of their property for the construction.
From what I understand, they're going to put that highway right here on the north side of this property, between here and that grove of trees.
According to an online map of possible routes, Benjamin's livestock trading office could soon front a massive expressway. His family has owned land for generations.
And now they're talking about taking it away?
A bill is pending in the Illinois House that would give the Department of Transportation quick take powers for the expressway. It's basically a fast-track version of eminent domain. The state government chooses the land it wants and then tells a judge what it'll pay. Property owners can take that money and run or fight in court over the value, but that's after their land's been taken. Dan Tarlock is a professor at the IIT Chicago Kent College of Law. He says quick take is a common practice for states around the country. It's often used for public-private infrastructure projects like the Illiana Expressway.
In order to induce the private financing, quick take's a big incentive to invest. Otherwise, a lot of private money would be tied up.
State Senator Toy Hutchinson sponsored the bill. She says quick take also speeds up the process.
Eminent domain takes about 3 years, but quick take takes about 2. So if you add another 24 months for land acquisition, then we could be breaking ground in 2016.
Hutchinson says the project could create around 14,000 long-term jobs and could bring $6 billion in investment over the next 30 years. But she says she does feel for landowners who could lose their land, especially in a region where most property is passed down through generations. Todd Benjamin says that doesn't matter to him and his neighbors.
It wouldn't make any difference if it was 6 years or six generations. It's yours. It's not theirs.
In Chicago, I'm Lauren Chulgin for Marketplace.
So, Jeremy, you know that Siri sound?
That one. Yes, I
yeah,
do.
That one. Well, there's a patent for that. Apple has just filed a patent application for the double beep, the one that's associated with its voice recognition system, Siri. The funny thing is Apple's already gotten nearly 40 patents for Siri, which seems, I don't know, Jeremy, does it seem excessive to you?
Yeah, just for two little dings like that.
I know.
Don't hate the player, hate the game.
Well, Stacey, finally, let's go to the British Cheese Board, which wants a new new national anthem for the UK's most popular cheese, cheddar. So, Stacey, it's asking
that
people
to
come
to
up with, well, that's right. It's God Save the Queen, and they want people to come up with lyrics to the tune of songs like that. One cheesemaker told the BBC it'll be a fun way to combine two of the best things in life, music and cheese.
Those are two of the best things in life.
God Save the Cheese is too easy. Or Cheese Save the Queen. I don't know what, you know.
I like God Save the Cheese.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.